Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know?
Yes, we did.
Solartopia.
We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Just glad to be with you for with our crew in New York. We're going to have two great guests today. Bob Fitrakis, my longtime co-conspirator, on so many articles on election protection, you name it. And we have just recently published a major piece on Richard Nixon's treason in Vietnam about the with the sabotage of the peace talks that he did there in concert with the evil Henry Kissinger. And we're also joined by a guy who wrote a piece about it himself, David Swanson. Guys, are you both with me? Do we have Bob? Do we have David? All right, I'm going to continue to talk. When Bob and David come in, if they do, please let me know. We're a little without Skype today, unfortunately, but we will make do. The piece that Bob Fitrakis and I wrote for the Columbus Free Press, which has gone pretty much viral around the internet, talks about the sabotage of the 1968 peace talks between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese government as, shall we say, facilitated by Lyndon Johnson, then President of the United States. And Johnson's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, was running for president at the time and was behind Richard Nixon, the Republican, the new Nixon, as he was called at the time, as he was marketing himself, knowing that he was such an unpopular and distasteful kind of guy. And as push came to shove with the 1968 election drawing closer, the Johnson administration clearly had a deal of some kind, very, very close to fruition between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese. Now, Nixon had, of course, his desires to become president at any cost, and he also, as it turns out, had a secret line into the Johnson camp through Henry Kissinger. Kissinger was employed by Lyndon Johnson as a foreign policy advisor, and was involved with the peace negotiations, the ceasefire negotiations between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese. And secretly, and this is totally astounding, and I hope David and Bob will jump in here and tell us about it, secretly informed Nixon of the nature of the talks, and Nixon went ahead and gave word. Bob Fitrakis, are you with us? Am I missing Bob or David Swanson? Are you with us? Neither one. Okay, so Nixon actually informed his liaison to the South Vietnamese government, Anna Chenault, that to tell them to not sign the peace treaty and to not proceed with a ceasefire, because he knew, and the whole world knew, that if there was a ceasefire prior to the voting in 1968, in November of 1968, that Hubert Humphrey would win the election. And happened then was that Nixon successfully sabotaged the peace talks between the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese. And the war proceeded, and Nixon won. And as a result of that, of course, we had seven more years of war, and that was it. And that was basically an act of treason on the part of Richard Nixon and of Henry Kissinger. Kissinger later, amazingly enough, got the Nobel Prize for solving a war that he prolonged. And these guys were never. We do know, we have reasonable understanding that Lyndon Johnson knew that this had happened. He actually called Nixon in and talked to Nixon, told Nixon that, or accused Nixon, let's put it that way, of sabotaging the peace talks between the North and South Vietnamese. And, you know, the rest is awful, ugly history. So, let me see here. I've got an email from David Swanson, and he's trying to call. David, are you there? Are you on the line? Hello?
Hello, this is Bob Trakas.
Hey, Bob. How are you? Have you been listening
in?
Okay. I haven't been hearing.
I've been on just a minute or so.
Okay, great. Unfortunately, I am on the road, and my MacBook has lost my Skype. And so I'm flying a little blind here, but we're going to do great. David Swanson, are you on the phone as well? All right, Bob, let's proceed. I've just emailed David Swanson, and he'll probably call in. So, Bob Fitrakis, you are my co-conspirator for the last 20 years. You and I have co-authored countless articles and broken many of the major stories about stolen elections in this country, especially from 2004 in Ohio. But now you and I have a piece out about this treasonous sabotage of the 1968 peace talks by Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. So can you give us a bit more detail? I think you've heard most of what I said as a setup.
Well, yeah, I mean, the part of what spurred the story on, of course, was the fact that George Will, a great admirer of Nixon and who works with the Nixon papers there, confirmed what had historically been called a conspiracy theory, right? So it's another conspiracy theory, of course, proven true. And in fact, there's a tremendous debate going on the right. Pat Buchanan, of course, just completely denies it. And I think it's Roger Stowe, who's got a new book out, which he actually sent parts of it to the Free Press for us to look at. He argues it's not treason. He admits it happened, but it was just Richard Nixon stopping Lyndon Johnson's October surprise so that it was justified to, you know, justified to torpedo the peace talks. And again, other people had done great work, Robert Perry, who went in and dug out the tapes. That includes, of course, Lyndon Johnson and Senator Dirksen's conversation where Johnson directly tells the Republican senator that Nixon committed treason. But he had other people at work. Again, reports that Clark Clifford was talking about, you know, the good of the nation, how we had to accept this destruction of the peace accords, because to reveal it, you know, the people of the United States wouldn't be able to take the harsh reality of a system that's based on treason and blackmail.
Well, guys in New York, we do have David Swanson calling in. He's been unable to get through so far, so if you can possibly call him back, that'd be great. Bob, the sabotage of the peace talks, does that qualify as treason? What is the status of legality of a private citizen doing to the Vietnam peace talks what Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did in 1968?
Well, there's actually an interesting debate going on online because it clearly violates the Logan Act, which prohibits private citizens from interfering in
David.
U.S. foreign policy. The broader question, since treason, of course, is giving aid and comfort to the enemy, part of the argument, well, it's not actually the enemy because it's our ally in South Vietnam. But if they're acting against your interest and conspiring to prolong a war that the elected official of the United States is about to negotiate and into, they are, in fact, the enemy. So a lot of debate is going to be around technical issues. Is does South Vietnam, which was little more than a puppet state, and I think in our article we make it real clear. I mean, you had the president there who was installed by the U.S., who was tied to the drug trade out of, places like Long Chen, where everyone knew he was refinancing his campaign through that Air America money that was all over Southeast Asia. So,
hi, this is David.
It is a technical debate, and I think you got David Swanson on. I just heard his voice.
All right, David, very good. So the wonders of technology have and good karma have won out yet again. David, I don't know how much you've heard, but you have written another article. Bob Strakis and I have written one article about the sabotage of the peace talks in 1968 between North and South Vietnam, which were sabotaged by Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. And we have just had America's most pompous bloviator, George Will, confirm the story. Bob's been talking about a bit about the legalities here. Do you believe that what Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon did to the peace talks in 1968 rises to the level or falls to the level, whichever you might choose, of actual treason?
Yeah. By the way, I tried forever to get in on my landline, and it never worked. I tried my cell phone, and it went right through. So I hope you can hear me okay on cell phone quality, because that's what we've got.
Well, you're fine. You sound good to me. And I want to introduce both of you guys, since we're just starting off here on a good, clean footing. Bob Petrakis, as they say, has been my co-conspirator, as professor of political science at Columbia State Community College, a great writer, publisher of the Columbus Free Press, and keeps it with Suzanne single-handedly alive over all these decades. David Swanson is one of America's great peace activists, incredibly prolific and articulate spokesman for peace and for justice and for the real American way. So, David, I was prompted to have you on. I always love having you on. You've been on my show a few times, as has Bob, but your article was the only other one out there on the Internet that really underscored the gravity of what was done in 1968. I mean, sometimes you just have to pinch yourself and say, these guys actually interfered in a peace negotiation, a ceasefire negotiation, and prolonged the war 7 years. David, is that actually what happened?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, it's been extremely well confirmed to the point where there is no longer any debate, confirmed by documentary records, by recordings of President Johnson and so forth. And what I was focused on, the reason why I wanted to write something about it, was because it seems to have become fashionable now for commentators and analysts and mainstream corporate bloviators to acknowledge that this happened, but to downplay it, minimize it, bury it in the background of the commentary, which is something I find outrageous. I don't know that I go along with your phrasing that George Will has confirmed it. I don't consider George Will an expert or a source of reliable information on anything. But I think he's a prominent example of someone who refers to the analysis of academics that are acceptable to them, and then downplays what happens and tries to make it sort of acceptable ancient history, but not that big of a deal. I think treason in most people's minds is a grave enough word to capture what was done. I personally, because I don't have any interest in nations, don't consider working against the government of a nation to be the most serious sin. But I do consider instigating or prolonging a war or justifying a war after the fact, which creates the momentum for further wars, to be the very worst thing that anybody can do. And here it was done for personal gain and no other possible mitigating excuse. So I think this is one of the more outrageous things that any U.S. politician has done, and that's saying something.
Well, Bob Fitrakis, you are an attorney. I know, and David, I totally agree with you in terms of your anti-statism. But we do have a legal system in this country. And Bob, as an attorney, do you think that you could successfully prosecute Henry Kissinger, who's still alive, apparently, and maybe we could exhume Nixon and sit him in a dock? Do you think that given your knowledge of the American legal code, that what they did in 1968 is technically treason?
It really comes down to a definition. I think there's a better case against Nixon, but I would add that, of course, there's a much better case for, you know, charging Kissinger with crimes against humanity, particularly for what he did in Cambodia. I think he's clearly, Kissinger's clearly guilty of the Logan Act as a private citizen, who, by the way, was supposed to be working with the Johnson campaign, but was in fact double-crossing them and interfering in the foreign policy of the United States during times of war.
But it's staggering to me. I mean, Henry Kissinger is still an object of great, you know, reverence, and people think of him as a smart guy and an important guy. And this is a guy, and correct me, David Swanson or Bob Fitrakis, this is a guy, I mean, you have to put both feet on the ground and say this. This is a guy who was employed by the Democratic Party, Lyndon Johnson, the incumbent president, to conduct the business of the government in negotiating a peace treaty in the middle of a presidential election campaign. And in the middle of the presidential election campaign, Henry Kissinger, while in Lyndon Johnson's employ, secretly communicates with the guy he's running against and coordinates or help coordinates the sabotage of peace talks. And this guy is walking around like a hero, and he's a Nobel Prize winner. What drug am I on?
Well, the one that says that he's also should be charged with crimes against humanity for overthrowing the second longest democracy in the Western Hemisphere, the Allende government in Chile. So, I mean, we could do a whole show on how many crimes that Kissinger should be charged with if we were a just society.
David, what's your opinion on that?
I think you could get Kissinger or Nixon on an anti-conspiracy statute to lying, deceiving, defrauding any agency of the U.S. government is a felony. I think you could get them on violating the U.N. Charter. I think you could get them on violating the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which was created through what I consider noble and good violations of the Logan Act, that is, peace activists going abroad and doing diplomacy that resulted in a treaty. I think lying to the Congress, lying to the public, and prolonging a war while claiming to be working for peace and have a plan for peace should Nixon be elected president rises to a level above anything that Nixon was about to be impeached for, or he, with the possible exception of the impeachment articles on Cambodia that did not pass out of the Judiciary Committee.
All right, so let's talk about that. And by the way, we're with David Swanson, great American peace activist, and Bob Fitrakis, publisher of the Columbus Free Press.
Yeah, let me just throw in Nuremberg, Article 6, Sections 1 and 2.
Bobby didn't even let me
for waging aggressive war. Essentially, I mean, by scuttling the peace talks, they prolonged a illegal and aggressive war. I mean, they had no reason to continue it with the peace talks about to be accepted. So they're responsible for all those deaths under Nuremberg. And remember, that's what they hung the Nazi generals under.
Yes, and of course, at the time this happened, in October, November of 1968, the United States was not yet involved in Cambodia. Is that correct? Weren't we already bombing Cambodia? I don't think we'd started when this happened.
Yeah, usually that's linked to 1970s. I'm not real sure. We may have been involved with the Mao or the Hmong, but we weren't involved in the mass bombings that, you know, clearly was a war crime.
David, your piece, which you ran at your website, rootsaction.org, Bob and I used George Will basically because he's been such a fixture of the right wing. And, you know, the point of his column was not to confirm this awful treason, but he did it in passing, trying to make a really lame point about IRS, Internal Revenue Service, being used against the right wing. Somehow, George Will managed to, in his bloviational fantasies, to connect the sabotage of the 1968 peace talks with the use of the IRS. Do you recall that from his column?
I do. It was at the very end, unless maybe some of the column was cut off in the version I read. I don't know. It didn't seem to make any sense. It was just one of these sort of throw something right-wingish into an otherwise more or less sane column in order to maintain your right-wing credentials. It seemed extraneous to me. I think Robert Perry, among others, has done a great job of writing about this crime of Nixon's better than George Will, or probably even I think the academic from the Miller Center here in Charlottesville that Will was relying on, named Kent Hughes. I haven't read his new book, but I think Bob Perry has done the best job in any books or articles that I have read, and I think that this incident helps explain Watergate and helps explain the later lesser Nixonian crises that left everyone in Washington imagining that the cover-up is worse than the crime, better than the understanding that people have who don't really grasp what the crimes were. And that as a motivation for the demanded break-in and firebombing of the Brookings Institution that Nixon wanted so badly, this makes a lot more sense than several of the other supposed explanations of what the documents were that Nixon so badly wanted out of the Brookings Institution, but was apparently not actually being forthcoming with his own staff as to what they were. That is, I don't think Nixon was ever as motivated by trying to attack somebody else as he was by trying to protect himself. And if he thought there was evidence of his crimes amounting to treason in the Brookings Institution, that would explain his desire to blow the place up.
Wow. So, yes, as I recall, your column basically said that the root of Watergate was, you know, it was never really clarified in much of the public discussion of Watergate, of what exactly he was looking for in the Democratic Party headquarters there. And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, David Swanson, but your thesis is essentially that he was looking for the documents that would have linked him to the sabotage of the 1968 peace talks. Is that correct?
Well, not in the Democratic Committee headquarters in the Watergate building, but in the Brookings Institution, which was never actually broken into, but which we've known since way back when Nixon was vehemently and with his usual colorful and cursing language insisting that his staff break into or firebomb and get those documents. But there's always been great speculation around what those documents were. This is prior to the break-in at the Democratic Party. Part of the explanation for which, if you ask the members of Veterans for Peace who protested at the convention down in Miami, was that they were trying to find connections between the Democrats and the peace activists. But regardless, that's later. The beginning of the sort of cover-up madness is with Nixon wanting to break into the Brookings Institution. And, you know, historians have said, well, maybe he wanted evidence that Kennedy had murdered DM, or he wanted evidence that LBJ had halted the bombing of Vietnam just prior to the election because he wanted Humphrey to win, or something of that sort, which none of which seems to rise to the level of explaining why Nixon, out of the blue, is yelling at his staff to firebomb the Brookings Institution, and they're refusing to do it because he isn't quite persuading them of the importance, possibly because he wasn't telling them what he actually wanted. And so now you have these sort of mainstream academics that George Will believes in, themselves believing that what Nixon actually wanted, and this is what others have believed for some time now, was this evidence that he had sabotaged the peace talks, and he believed it to be in the Brookings Institution, even though it actually wasn't.
Now, Bob Fitrakis, does that square with your research on this?
Well, it sort of explains this weird rant where he's telling them literally to take it out, firebomb it. You know, at the time you're thinking, you know, I remember when the first time I read it thinking, you know, I thought Richard Nixon was moderate. I mean, what could possibly the moderate Brookings Institute done to enrage Nixon, but it makes sense if you thought the evidence was in that policy institution's safe.
All right, so I want to every once in a while, you know, we have to do a reality check. I once heard a speech from Paul Krasner. I dearly love a great political comedian, the publisher of the realist, and who himself published some of the most outrageous fantasies on earth. But he says, basically, when you hear something like this, you got to flap your wings and see if you fly. And if you don't, then you're not dreaming. So we have the president of the United States, the duly elected, or unduly elected, leader of the free world, telling his staff to firebomb a think tank in Washington, D.C., within a mile of the White House, to destroy documents that link him to sabotaging peace talks and prolonging the war in Vietnam by 20,000 deaths on the American side, and God knows how many on the Vietnamese. Is that the reality of what we're talking about?
Well, I don't think there's yet universal agreement that was the motivation for going after Brookings Institution. But the point of both of our columns, I think, was that there is now accepted universal acknowledgement that, in fact, Nixon did sabotage the peace talks for his own electoral gain with no intention of achieving peace at that time or later, and that the result was tens of thousands of U.S. deaths and at least a million additional Vietnamese deaths, rising to a total of 4 million Vietnamese dead from a criminal enterprise that began before Nixon's presidency, but that he continued when there was a clear opening and a clear possibility and probability of peace arriving prior to Nixon moving into the White House. And it's in the same pattern as the sabotage of the hostage release under Carter that was delayed until Reagan moved into the White House and so forth, and legally rises to the same standard of sick, dishonest manipulation of the electorate and the government, but with much more blood as a result.
Bob Fitrakis,
Well, I mean, the interesting part is, you know, the right, I mean, people like Stowe, who's been pushing his book on this subject as well, and actually refers to a call from Nixon to Humphrey after the election, kind of acknowledging, and again in 72, following McGovern running for office, and Nixon kind of alludes to the fact that he and, you know, Humphrey and, of course, Johnson knew what was in the best interest of the country by not going public. So, you know, it really is hard to imagine what would be more important than this paper. And, of course, the NSA had all this information. I mean, there were numerous, you know, they had been following all the cables out of Saigon and had been monitoring the whole sabotage of the peace accords. And the odd thing, of course, is Lyndon Johnson didn't go public with it. And the right is now talking about how he was a great American by looking at, and this was the line that Clark Clifford, you know, the man fundamental in the founding of the CIA, who argued persuasively to Johnson that the American people couldn't handle the truth.
Yeah, right. And that line from an officer and a gentleman, you can't handle the truth. That's what these guys said to the American public. We are going to take a short 3-minute break here to let this sink in. And I'm going to repeat the staggering reality with David Swanson and Bob Trakas, and then we're going to proceed into the next quagmire to sort it out, which is, of course, the war in Iraq and the insane, vicious lies. And I want to make it clear that this is all 10 years, 20 years ago, this is all leftist conspiracy theory, which has now proved to be 100% true. We're at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you for my crew in New York for bearing with me without our Skype. Let's take a 3-minute break, and we'll be back with Bob Petrakis and David Swanson.
Traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia. It's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me.
Don't complain about your cable bill going up and up and up. Do something about it. Grab a pencil and jot down this special number.
877-764-MY-TV.
The more cable TV rates go up, the better digital satellite TV looks. Say goodbye to the cable guy and get more of your favorite high-definition channels in 100% digital quality for less money.
Call 877-764-MY-TV.
Right now to sign up for packages starting under $1 per day. Yes, $1 per day, and there's no equipment to buy. That includes your free HD upgrade, your free DVR upgrade, and your free professional installation. So what are you waiting for? Pull out your major credit or debit card.
Call 877-764-MY-TV. That's 877-764-MY-TV.
Say goodbye to the cable guy. Cut costs and start saving.
877-764-MY-TV. That's 877-764-MY-TV.
Upgrades and installation on select packages. Prices and programming subject to change. 24-month commitment required. Early termination fee and other restrictions apply.
877-764-MY-TV.
Hi, I'm George Foreman. Do you have an idea for a new product or invention? People ask me all the time, George, how do I get my idea in front of companies? How do I get a patent? What do I do next? Do you have the same questions? I'll tell you like I'll tell them all. Call my friends at InventHelp.
Call InventHelp today for free information. InventHelp can submit your invention to companies who are interested in receiving new ideas.
To get your free inventor's information, call 1-800-359-4704. That's 1-800-359-4704.
Coal plants, nuke plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
Yes, indeed.
Powered energy.
That's the future for you and me. That's Dana Lyons singing Solartopia, Rocky Top version. Thank you, Dana, as always. Cows with Guns fame, over 4 million views on YouTube at the two different editions, I guess you'd call them, of the Cows with Guns video. Always take a look at that. We're on with two great guests, David Swanson, one of our most prolific and powerful peace activists, Bob Fitrakis, my longtime co-conspirator, publisher of the Columbus Free Press and freepress.org. Both, all three of us have been involved in publishing articles about the sabotage of the 1968 peace accords. I want to say again that, you know, for decades, we on the left have been accused of being conspiracy theorists. How can we ever argue that a president of the United States would intervene and sabotage peace talks? And anyone who would come forward and say such a thing has always been scoffed at and denigrated and poo-pooed by the right wing. And now there is 100% certainty. There, as a historian, there is absolutely no doubt that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did, in fact, sabotage the peace talks between the North and South Vietnamese in 1968, deliberately prolonged the war in Vietnam, resulting in tens, hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is now part of the absolute history of the United States. So now in more recent times, I want to make an analogy very quickly, of course, to the nuclear power industry against which I've worked for so many years. Way back when people on the anti-nuclear side would say that a nuclear power plant might blow up, the nuclear industry would always waltz in and say, you are conspiracy theorists, it's physically impossible for a nuclear power plant to blow up. And we almost had an explosion at the Fermi nuclear plant near and dear to Bob and my heart in Detroit, Michigan in 1968. We did have a small explosion at Three Mile Island in 1979, where the industry denied that there was any fuel melted, and in fact, fuel did melt. That's indisputable. Chernobyl blew up in 1986, and the industry said, well, that's the Soviet reactor. And now, as of Fukushima, we have had 4 explosions at commercial atomic power plants made by General Electric. Another conspiracy theory that proves out to be not such a conspiracy theory after all, but the the absolute truth. So here we go now we've been through Vietnam. Let's talk about Iraq. Let's talk about what the American people were told and by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Karl Rove, and what really turned out to be. So Bob Fitrakis, give us a quick line, and David, jump in, and let's see, does this, like the Vietnam sabotage, violate federal law? Should these guys be prosecuted?
Well, clearly the, Karl Rove, among others, should have been prosecuted for the Valerie Plame situation. That's a 10-year felony. You know, the fact that he didn't mention her specific name, but just her husband. And, you know, it's the fact that they absolutely, you know, misled the American public. And, you know, what some of them said under oath in that administration, they need to be held accountable. But not U.S. law, but I think international law. Again, the U.N. Charter, which David has already invoked, saying this was an illegal, aggressive war. George Bush and Dick Cheney, as well as Karl Rove, who, recall, said that George Bush was going to be a war president when there was no war. And then he essentially leaks the name of a covert CIA agent in order to make sure that his cover story for this false and illegal war could continue. So clearly, Bush and Cheney are war criminals, and Karl Rove should be in jail for leaking the name of Valerie Plame.
Yes, now Valerie Plame, to make it clear, was a CIA agent undercover who was married to, was it Richard Wilson?
No, Joe Wilson.
Joseph Wilson, who did a study
and showed that Saddam, well, David, why don't you take it from there? Because you know this story very, very well, and you've been one of the major people leading the charge to make it public. So let me give it to you.
Well, yeah, I have a little bit different take in that if it can be done safely without leading to additional violence and harm to the individuals involved, I'm in favor of leaking the name of every damn CIA agent there is and of exposing everything the CIA does and of shutting it down. I think it is harmful. I think it does far more damage than good. And I think the secrecy of it is unjustifiable. It's only justified by the evocation of foreign enemies, but the secrecy is used to keep what the government is doing secret from the people in whose name it's doing it, and I don't think that's the crime. I think the crime is the war, but George W. Bush campaigned as a war president. He said in the primary debates that he was going to launch this war. It doesn't begin to excuse it morally or legally, but he's a little bit different case from someone like Richard Nixon, who campaigned on peace while planning war, or Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt, or Barack Obama, who campaigned on ending war. And that wasn't the whole of it if you looked into the details. But if you just heard his speeches at rallies, he was going to end the war in Iraq. He now, once elected, did everything he could to prolong the occupation of Iraq, was ultimately unable to do it because of a treaty put together by Bush and Maliki and the Iraqi government's refusal to allow U.S. troops to stay with immunity for crimes. Now an opportunity has developed to reopen that war, and President Obama has jumped into it with everything he could. As far as misleading the public, I think, you know, Obama has as much going for him as George W. Bush. And I think that certainly these wars violate the UN Charter and are aggressive. But I think that the Kellogg-Briand Pact is worth remembering, and that the ban is and ought to be on all wars, whether we describe them as aggressive or UN approved or otherwise, because it is the existence of those loopholes, that the idea that the UN might approve a war or a war might be defensive, that allows people to imagine that some of these wars are acceptable, even though the loopholes are never actually met. So I think we need to deal with war itself, every single instance of it, as the greatest crime our government engages in.
Well, let's talk, David. You mentioned the Kellogg-Briand Pact. I'm not sure many of our listeners will know what that is. I happen to know because I'm a historian, but give us a rundown of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and why do you think it's still relevant today?
Well, after World War One, which, of course, began a century ago this year and ran for 4 years with the U.S. in the last year and a half of it, the public sentiment in this country and around the world was very strongly for peace, and the peace movement was very mainstream and well-funded and almost universal, and it pushed various approaches for a decade. And after a decade, on August 27th, 1928, figured out something that could be done, and it was to criminalize war. War had been legal. Various atrocities and excesses had been illegal, but war itself was just sort of like the weather. That changed, and wars were ended. The acceptability of seizing territory ceased. Wars were prevented. But then wars came, and World War II came. And so there are historians who will tell you, and liberal lawyers who will tell you, that because World War II came, the Kellogg-Briand Pact didn't work. Even though following World War II, under the Kellogg-Briand Pact, for the first time in history, the prosecuting of war was prosecuted as a crime. And the wealthy armed nations of the world have never gone to war with each other since. They've just gone to war through proxies and on poor countries. Here's a law that's on the books, on the State Department's website, accepted by 85 countries. There are those who will argue that the UN Charter replaces it. But it's a tough argument to make, and it's at least an argument that exposes the UN Charter as legalizing war rather than what it is almost universally understood as, which is the exact opposite, criminalizing war. Criminalizing war had been done in 1928.
Are you saying, David, that the Calgary-Vianque Act was the legal basis for the prosecutions of the war crimes at Nuremberg?
It was indeed, and there's some good articles in some law journals that I cite in one of my books and that I can send you to that tell the story of a lawyer who came up with that idea and gave it to Franklin Roosevelt, who gave it to everyone else, and that was the way it went, as they were trying to figure out how to prosecute the Germans and how to prosecute them under the laws of each separate nation that they abused and how they could possibly prosecute every crime. And FDR bought and decreed that they would proceed on the theory that this lawyer from New York had come up with, and that was to remember the even then almost already forgotten Kellogg-Briand Pact, which became the supreme law of the land in the United States and all the other major wealthy countries and their colonies and possessions in the beginning of 1929.
So, Bob Petrakis, as an attorney, what do you think about using the Calgary-Vianque platform as a vehicle to possibly prosecute members of the Bush administration for leading us into Iraq on such under false pretenses?
Oh, I think they could. I think it's the underpinning as well to the Nuremberg trials in that I think they could be published under, you know, Nuremberg principles, which have become customary international law, as well as the UN Charter. I mean, again, in the situation, the exemption, you know, in the UN Charter or a common is preemptive war, right? The other side is just about to attack you, so you have to attack first. That was refuted. Remember, the German generals argued that Poland attacked Germany. No one bought that. I mean, Bush used the term preemption, that we attacked Iraq because they might attack us in the future. But again, that's preventative war. That is illegal because, you know, Kellogg-Briand, because of everything, you know, not only the total outlawing of war, but everything that came afterwards, particularly Nuremberg Article 6, Sections 1 and 2, that makes waging aggressive war clearly illegal. So, again, you cannot attack a country because at some unforeseen time in the future, they may pose a threat. The only exception is if they, you know, they're you know, sending their tanks to the border. They're mobilizing to attack you. And clearly what George Bush did was an illegal preventive war, which, you know, he should be held accountable and punished for. And I think all of that flows, I think David's right, from Kellogg-Briand and that impulse to criminalize war.
Who, David, who signed the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and why is it still considered, why do you still consider it to be an active standard to be met under the legal system?
Well, it was signed on, you know, the day that someone had the strangest dream that all the world had agreed to put an end to war in Paris, France, on August 27th, 1928, with the French and Germans meeting peacefully for the first time, and the United States and these other countries recognizing the existence of the Soviet Union for the first time, and so forth, and all of the flags of the world flying in Paris, France, and around the building where it was signed. And this was, of course, the single biggest story of that year. It just has been written out of our history books. And the major wealthy nations, I list them all in my book, When the World Outlawed War, the major wealthy nations of the world signed on their own behalf and the behalf of their colonies and territories. So quite a good bit of hypocrisy going on. But, you know, Germany, the United States, the United Kingdom, Belgium, France, the whole British Empire, India, and Poland and Czechoslovakia and so forth, and then more were added subsequently over the decades, and now currently 85 some countries are listed as parties to the treaty, treaties under the U.S. Constitution, Article 6, are the supreme law of the land, higher than anything other than the Constitution itself. So those who insist that the Constitution legalizes war and therefore neither the U.N. Charter nor the Kellogg-Briand Pact has any legal merit can maintain that point of view and reject this treaty along with others. But those who understand the Constitution not to require any wars and not to mandate any wars, and understand that treaties are the highest law of our land in addition to the Constitution, have to respect the existence of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, unless you try to argue that the United Nations Charter undoes it. But there's been no legal case made for that. The problem is that that the Kellogg-Briand Pact includes no particular mechanism for prosecution. The courts of law and the systems of law and arbitration had still to be developed, and nothing has been put on the books. And that we now do finally have an international criminal court, but it is under the thumb of the permanent members of the Security Council. It has not even accepted the idea of prosecuting even so-called aggressive war, much less all war. And if it ever does, it will be just for Africans if current trends continue. So this idea of making war illegal and enforcing that ban on war through nonviolent means remains very much a work in progress. The alternative approach established by the U.N. Charter and NATO and the whole world order of post-World War II of banning war through the use of good war has proven to be a counterproductive, absolute disaster for 75 years.
Talking with David Swanson, author of numerous books, peace activist, rootsaction.org, Bob Petrakis, publisher of the Columbus Free Press, professor of political science at Columbus State Community College, and my co-conspirator on about a half dozen books on election protection and more. So, Bob, as an attorney, do you want to file some prosecution on George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and see where it flies? What do you think?
Well, I would love to. I think David's pointed out, I mean, the fact that the U.S., exempts itself from the International Criminal Court and doesn't even prosecute its private contractors that do things like Dyncorp in the former Yugoslavia, two of their employees busy out there, setting up prostitution rings from women that were brutalized in that civil war, is that there's plenty of war crimes to go out. And I think the point on the Obama administration, I wish, from my perspective, I would have thrown in Libya as well, which the absurdity of Obama suggesting that it wasn't the United States that overthrew that sovereign head of state in Libya and has given us the jihadiists shattering that country, but NATO, and sort of like the Soviet Union in the old day, blaming something on the Warsaw Pact. So I think Obama is equally guilty of waging an illegal war against Libya and making the world more unsafe as well.
So what we have here, and we're drawing nigh on the end of this show, and I really appreciate having two such committed and powerful speakers on behalf of this situation is, the attempt to bring peace to the world finally, is that I think the confirmation of the conspiracy theory about the sabotage of the 1968 Vietnam peace talks is extremely important. It's yet another instance where the left has been continually attacked for alleged lack of credibility, and yet turns out to be 100% accurate. David, in passing, you mentioned the conspiracy, the alleged conspiracy to withhold the release of hostages from Iran in 1980 when, again, in an election situation, an incumbent Democrat, this time Jimmy Carter, could have clearly been reelected if the hostages had been released. And yet the conspiracy theorists have said, and believe me, I was involved in this. It's one of the few things I actually raised money for. We had the October Surprise campaign to point out that there was overwhelming evidence that George H.W. Bush, as an emissary for Ronald Reagan, along with William Casey, the future head of the CIA, did intervene with the Islamic radicals, in this case Ayatollah Khomeini, to keep the hostages until after 1980, telling them the same thing that Richard Nixon told the South Vietnamese in 1968, if you do this, we will win and we will give you a better deal. Do we think that the proof of the 1980 October Surprise hostage retention conspiracy is now as strong as the 1968 Vietnam conspiracy theory? Is that as well established? What do you guys think?
I am as persuaded of that one as of the earlier one. I'm also persuaded of George H.W. Bush's involvement in the assassination of Kennedy. So you know, more than one transfer of the White House on his hands. But the difference is that with the Reagan plot in Iran, it has not become acceptable, mainstream, downplayed, understood history yet the way that Nixon's Treasonous Act now has. And so I don't know if that's going to be just a matter of passage of time or it's going to require additional evidence, but to my mind the evidence is there in equal measure for both. One has just not yet become accepted. And I think understanding these patterns of lies helps us understand the lies that were told about Libya, about the supposed crisis to be averted, the lies that were told last fall about Syria that were rejected, and the lies we're being told right now about Iraq and the need to bomb people for humanitarian reasons in Iraq, which is something that only Americans seem to believe in, humanitarian bombing. The rest of the world seems to think there are other approaches to crises than bombing.
Bob Petraeus?
Well, there's tons of evidence. You had Gary Sick, the security officer early on, who wrote the book, now a professor. You had Barbara Nose Honinger, who worked for the Reagan administration, who came out and wrote a book about the deal. You had Bonnie Sauter, the brief president of the Iranian Republic, releasing documents and writing a book about it. You had stuff from the former Soviet archives. I mean, everyone pretty much knows what happened, these hostages were kept for a long period of time in order to make Ronald Reagan president, and really with George Herbert Walker Bush, the former CIA, leader who cut these deals.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm going to go out and break a few windows now. This is really hard stuff to handle. David Swanson and Bob Petraeus, you have always been great guests, and we'll have you back to confirm the rest of the conspiracy theories in our history. This is a shocking moment to me, and I hope to our listeners as well. Thank you, crew in New York, for your forbearance, and we will be back in our home office next week with another Solartopia. Be powerful.
We needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power.